Part 2.
So I guess we started off with the thought that some psychopaths at least seem to be able to understand moral claims, or they can understand the moral game, but actually what you're saying is there is a deeper form of understanding that they don't have. So they might observe the shape or the interaction of different moral norms and people playing the moral game, but there's in a sense, they don't really get what the rules are.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yes, I think maybe they get what the rules are, but because they don't take those rules to apply to them, they don't understand what's underlying the rules, I suppose. Mm-hmm. That's the difference. So why do we have rules about how to interact with other people and how to treat other people? Well, it's because people are important, right? Because people have value. So I think you can understand the rules that other people are playing by, but if you don't take those rules to have any genuine force for yourself, then that shows that you don't understand the deeper underlying values that support those rules and give those rules meaning.
So I guess at this point it might be worth saying, so that seems to all make sense. Conceptually, philosophically, that picture hangs together well. But do we really have good reason to think that psychopaths can't understand that other people have value?
Yeah, so I think we do. And I think, when we talk about psychopaths, we're talking about a group of people who are kind of heterogeneous to some extent. You know, they have all sorts of different characteristics. But it seemed to me from engaging with the literature on psychopaths that there is at least a group of people who genuinely do lack this ability to see other people as having value. So it seems to me that the reason they don't is essentially developmental. So when you look at kind of neuroscientific findings and psychological findings about psychopaths, firstly, it seems like there is, you'll find either that there's a kind of underlying neurological deficit that people are born with, that means that they have problem with empathizing with other people, or they have some ability to empathize with other people, but that is then, you know, stunted and prevented from reaching its full manifestation because of either abuse or neglect or trauma of some kind in childhood. And the conclusion I reached basically was that if you have one of those characteristics, so, you know, from a fairly early age, you just are not in the game of empathizing with other people, that will then lead to you not seeing other people as having value in adult life. You can see this on a neurological level. It actually, you know, it makes a difference to the kind of structure and patterns of activity in your brain. But also you can see it on a psychological level. So the psychiatrists and so on would diagnose people as lacking empathy. And lacking empathy seems to be one of the central characteristics of psychopaths. So I looked at kind of developmental psychology and kind of drew the conclusion that basically if you have this really fundamental trouble with empathy, you don't get into the game of forming genuine moral principles in the first place. So you can kind of reconstruct that. So again, you know, you're able to understand the rules that other people are playing by, just by observing their behavior. But I think, not being able to empathize, it would appear, will tend to block off your ability to ascribe value to other people. And that's what seems to be missing. In what we were describing before in terms of, psychopaths being able to understand and apply rules, but not understand what's underlying them. It's the value of other people. So I think, so if you look at kind of what developmental psychologists write about the role of empathy in people's moral development, there's some really interesting stuff there. So, the way caregivers and educators and so on, encourage empathy in children has a really strong effect on their ability to empathize. You know, if there's various ways of kind of trying to teach children morality, you know, you might kind of just shout at them if they do something bad. You might, there's love withdrawal, that people will just kind of refuse to kind of give them a hug if they've done something bad. And, you know, actually, as a parent, you kind of, you do all of these to a greater or lesser extent. But, one of the things that seems really key is encouraging empathy as a basis for children coming to understand the moral reasons that apply to their actions. So instead of just saying, don't steal that child's toy, you know, you say, how would you feel if somebody stole your toy? And you just kind of keep plugging away at that, and it encourages them to empathize, but it also encourages them to, of course, see the situation from somebody else's point of view. And I think by seeing situations from other people's point of view and understanding the impact of your actions on others, not just kind of theoretically, but kind of imaginatively, it seems like that is a really important way that people develop the ability to see other people as having value. Because, you know, if you don't, if you never think about things from other people's point of view and never think about your actions in terms of their impact on other people, then you just don't get into that game of seeing other people as having value and therefore, you know, using moral principles in an engaged way, not just in a kind of theoretical way, but in a genuinely kind of emotionally engaged way, I suppose. And it seems, it just kind of seems empirically that people who just don't get that at all right from the start, they do grow up with these unusual personalities, and with something missing that seems like it, to me, seems like the missing ingredient in moral responsibility.
So if we were to try and, I don't know, I'm always tempted to use a metaphor. So if we were to try and picture what the crux of the psychopath's problem with engaging in the moral game is, there's this, empathy is normally like a bridge we can cross to enter someone else's mindset. And maybe with a psychopath, there is just a block across the bridge saying, like, bridge out of operation, or it was never built in the first place, or...
Yeah, it was never built in the first place, or maybe it's been destroyed, you know, somebody's blown it up. Yeah.
So are there other forms of mental illness which are characterized by a lack of empathy, and do these maybe pose a challenge for your picture of things? It sounds like a really compelling picture to me.
So
I imagine people saying this.
So that's right. So if you're going to use empathy as the basis for a big conclusion like this, then people are going to object, understandably, by saying, look, psychopathy isn't the only condition which seems to be characterized by a lack of empathy. And the one that's often appealed to here is autism or autistic spectrum disorder. But there are others, actually. So I'll discuss borderline personality disorder in the book. And there's also narcissistic personality disorder and various others. But just in terms of autism, I think it's kind of complicated there. So I think firstly, it seems, as far as I can see, to be quite controversial now about whether people with autism actually genuinely have difficulty empathizing or not. So this is the kind of, I think the traditional view is people with autism lack theory of mind. But some writers now have kind of called that into question, including some writers who are on the autistic spectrum themselves, and therefore ought to, you know, have some view on that. And so firstly, it's not clear that people with autism genuinely have difficulty empathizing, But if they do, and to the extent that they do, it does seem interestingly different from psychopaths. So it's, you know, when you say people with autism have trouble empathizing and psychopaths have trouble empathizing, you're really talking about a different thing. So if we think that empathizing is firstly imagining the world from another person's point of view, mm-hmm. but then secondly, feeling something emotionally on their behalf. Mm-hmm. So, you know, whether that's kind of imaginatively matching the emotional response that the other person's undergoing or feeling something. So it might be that kind of if you feel righteous indignation on somebody's behalf when they don't feel that themselves, in a way, that's a kind of empathetic response. But anyway, mm-hmm. feeling something emotionally on their behalf. Well, it seems like people with autism, if they do have trouble with empathy, it's traditionally characterized on the imaginative side. So it's having trouble imagining the world from another person's point of view and predicting their responses and so on. Whereas with psychopaths, it doesn't seem like they necessarily have trouble with that element. It's more the emotional response side. Whereas somebody with autism might kind of feel an emotional response on somebody else's behalf. So it seems like empathy has two components, and people with autism lack one if they do, and psychopaths lack the other. But it seems like it's the emotional response that we ought to be thinking about as key to moral responsibility on the kind of picture that I've been developing, right? Because, you know, in order to kind of feel the value of other people, it's actually having an emotional response on their behalf, which is going to give you that ability. Now, you know, not being able to imagine what it's like to be somebody else might interfere with moral responsibility to some extent, but possibly in a different way. So anyway, it seems like the picture that I've been developing isn't kind of vulnerable to that objection in quite that way, I guess. I don't know, what do you think?
I don't think it would be. So the way, just to kind of broadly characterize, a common folk understanding of psychopathy is that they have to, or they do exhibit that kind of cognitive empathy in the sense of the theory of mind being able to anticipate how someone is going to respond to different aspects of a situation, because that's what enables them to be quite manipulative.
Exactly,
be quite successful at manipulating, whereas people on the autistic spectrum are probably less capable of doing that. So what does that imply? That implies that the thing that would be, I'm not sure, what would that imply? The thing that's missing with psychopaths is not that same sort of empathy. Maybe you can finish that thought.
Yeah, so I suppose, I mean, the trouble is, I'm no expert on autism at all. I don't want to kind of make out that I am, or kind of draw these kind of sweeping conclusions that people might think are wrong. So, you know, take what I'm saying with a kind of pinch of salt. But I guess if you were on the autistic spectrum and you had trouble with imagining the world from another person's point of view, that wouldn't necessarily block you from thinking that that point of view is important,
yes,
I suppose. Yeah. So you might kind of imperfectly, imaginatively engage with the perspectives of other people, but what you wouldn't be prevented from doing was kind of feeling that response, yes, I suppose, and having that emotional element. So what you might end up with is an impaired ability to respond to reasons because you kind of wouldn't understand what some of those reasons were, but there's nothing blocking you from taking those reasons to appeal to apply to yourself. I suppose that's the thought.
So it's the ability to grasp that, as you were saying earlier, the mattering. The ability to have that mattering. So it might be that there are kind of stumbling points on the way to being able to connect that mattering with the imagined experience of the person you're kind of trying to empathize with, whereas there's something missing for psychopaths that's maybe more fundamental.
Yeah.
In that grasping the mattering.
Yeah. Kind of thing. Yeah. Yeah. So I guess my conclusion really is that it's an open question how one ought to apply moral responsibility to people with autism, right? Mm. So I'd have to do another book to answer that question.
Anyone listening? Anyone want to give you a
publishing? But at least the argument that I've been making in the context of psychopathy doesn't immediately apply to autism in the same kind of way. Yes. So you'd have to you know do some more arguing to get to the bottom of that one.
So you did mention there are other psychological conditions like borderline personality disorder and narcissistic personality disorder. I was just wondering if you could maybe say a little bit about those.
So to take narcissistic personality disorder first, so it seems to me that narcissistic personality disorder does actually have quite a lot of crossover with psychopathy in some way. So, you know, one of the elements in the hair checklist for psychopaths is a grandiose sense of self-worth. Mm. And that seems to be like the central characteristic of narcissistic personality disorder, right? Yeah. So it seems likely that there may be narcissistic personality disorder. And again, it does seem to interfere with people's ability to empathize. Mm. It seems like maybe... And this is quite tentative, and I don't even really cover narcissistic personality disorder in the book, so this is quite tentative. But it seems like actually, in contrast to autism, it does seem like the way that narcissistic personality disorder would interfere with empathy would actually be quite similar to the way it would interfere with empathy in the case of psychopaths. Because if you think you're the only important entity in the world, then I mean, by definition, you don't value other people, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Or you can only value them in relation to your own importance, I suppose.
Right, so yeah. So you can value them instrumentally, I suppose, yeah. Or extrinsically, yeah, in some kind of way, which I think probably psychopaths can as well. But, yeah, not to get into that. So, again, tentative, but it seems like people with narcissistic personality disorder actually might lack moral responsibility in a similar kind of way.
Okay, that's interesting.
Borderline personality disorder. So that's a complex one. So people with borderline personality disorder, what they seem to do is kind of set up idealized others. So they, when they interact with somebody, they won't kind of have a realistic view of that person's personality and motivations and what the way they're responding to them. They'll kind of swing between putting that person on a pedestal and feeling
let down by
feeling inadequate in comparison to them. And right. But then the other side of it is feeling let down by people. Feeling betrayed by people. So what seems to be happening is there seems to be something which is getting in the way of your ability to understand other people's personalities and motivations and so on. So the way other people relate to you is your picture of that is being interfered with by the condition that you have. So that you aren't really imagining the world from their point of view. You think you are, but actually what you're doing is imagining in a way that's kind of compromised by your own condition. Now, what does that say about moral responsibility? It's interesting because it does seem to affect the value side as well. Because you definitely do think of other people as valuable, but the kind of value that you're ascribing to them seems to at least to some extent be interfered with by the way.
It seems very self-focused.
It does seem very self-focused. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And you definitely do seem to be compromised in terms of your ability to understand things from other people's perspective. So again, in terms of moral responsibility, it seems like at least somebody with borderline personality disorder is in the game in the sense that they're able to ascribe value to other people. So again, if they lack moral responsibility, it's not for the same reasons that psychopaths don't, but they might lack moral responsibility for other reasons. So, you know, it might be that they are genuinely deluded about other people in a way which, you know, is beyond their control and that they aren't responsible for. And therefore, there might be some ways of responding to other people that people with borderline personality disorder, or at least kind of severe forms of it, might lack moral responsibility for that reason. So it'd be more analogous to the example that I gave right at the beginning about somebody who's kind of deluded into thinking that somebody they're interacting with is a hostile alien. It's a bit more like that. You're thinking that this person kind of has it in for you or is kind of has malicious intent towards you when they don't. And it might be that would call into question your moral responsibility for some ways of responding to them. But again, it's not in the same way that psychopaths lack moral responsibility.
Mm. I guess it's worth mentioning that there is a danger in talking about people with these conditions. So because I just caught myself there saying, it sounds quite self-focused. Often, my understanding is often these conditions are kind of deep-rooted in childhood neglect and abandonment. And that being the case, it would make sense that it relates to an inability to hold them morally responsible in the same way that we can't really hold children morally responsible, because they're just wired to be completely self-focused. So you can kind of do the attempting to train and, you know, do the sitting down and going like, well, do you know how that would make the other person feel?
Yeah.
All that kind of thing. I guess the issue with people with these personality disorders is that they're kind of locked into a developmental stage in a way that they didn't progress beyond.
That sounds plausible. Yeah. It's interesting. Yeah. So thinking about moral responsibility in children, I think actually what we do with children quite a lot of the time is we treat them as if they are morally responsible, even though we don't really think they are, in order to train them to think of themselves as being morally responsible.
Yes. So it's a bit disingenuous in a way when we go, you know, that's really bad.
what
you did there was really bad.
we act disappointed with them for behaving in various ways. And like, you know, I'm a parent and I think we kind of do that really. If you actually just purely treated them, you know, if it was an adult exhibiting the same behavior, you would just you wouldn't treat them in the same kind of way. But because it's a child and you know they are undergoing a developmental process and you want them to reach moral maturity, you're kind of treating them, you're behaving towards them in order to train them to think of themselves in the same kind of way. I suppose you might think, should we treat somebody with various forms of mental illness in the same kind of way? But I think the difference is that, you know, it's not obvious that kind of form of treatment is going to be the effective one in that kind of case, right? I mean, particularly with psychopaths. Mm. So you might think, let's treat psychopaths as morally responsible in order to train them to think of themselves as morally responsible, and therefore they might become morally responsible. But just looking at the kind of, well, so it's not that psychopaths are obviously completely recalcitrant to treatment. There have been attempts to treat psychopaths in various ways, and some of those have shown kind of tentatively some success, but it seems like, you know, just treating them as being morally responsible is not going to be the way to make a difference. You're going to have to get much deeper than that, I suppose.
Yeah. I guess the issue being that a lot of the patterns of relation are just very baked in by that, you know, once you're an adult, that's neuroplasticity doesn't the kind of layers are set down so much that these things are so deep rooted that intervention in the kind of way that you were describing with children and kind of training them, in a way the ship has maybe sailed to some extent.
I mean, not wanting to kind of draw that conclusion in too firm a way, because I think there's a danger that you just kind of write people off, right? And again, we're back to this point about, you know, psychopaths are real people, and the conclusions that I'm drawing might not apply to all of them. Everybody who's diagnosed as being a psychopath, right? So it might be that there are certain people who have certain mental resources, which despite, you know, having enough of the psychopathic traits to be diagnosed as being a psychopath, you know, there might be resources that people can draw on there in treating them and actually making a difference to their underlying personality. But it, so far, the results aren't that good, unfortunately. So if you look at the successful treatments, quite often it is either kind of quite short term. You sort of persuade psychopaths to behave in a certain way in the short term, but then they regress quite quickly.
So the natural equilibrium.
Or what you're doing is you're kind of persuading them that it's in their interest to act as if they, you know, do value other people or whatever, whereas they still genuinely don't. And as soon as those kind of immediate incentives are out of the way, they can revert to their old behaviour. But the other one is kind of comorbid disorders. So quite often somebody who's a psychopath will have some other disorder as well, and you can improve their kind of outlook by treating those comorbid disorders, but you're not necessarily treating the psychopathy itself.
Right. So I guess what we're getting onto now is that same question that we started, that you raised, you started with how should society treat psychopaths? And it seems like we've just considered ways in which you can't really hold them morally responsible because there's just a deficit in empathy there. So while we can't hold them morally responsible, maybe society still has to treat them in a certain way. Should we nonetheless maybe hold them criminally responsible?
So the answer to that question depends on to what extent you think the conditions of criminal responsibility should track the conditions of moral responsibility. And people do disagree about this. But it seems to me from the research that I have been able to do that it's quite rare in practice, actually, for the criminal law not to follow moral responsibility. It seems like the kinds of cases where people who you might not think are morally responsible are nonetheless criminally responsible are quite rare, and they don't really look like the kind of case that we're considering here. So it's more kind of strict liability kind of cases where it's thought important to just hold people criminally responsible for behaving in a certain way, even though it's in question whether they really are morally responsible for it. And that's not really what's at issue here. So you do find people arguing that it doesn't matter what people's motivations are, and what the criminal law should be doing is just setting out a set of rules and holding people responsible who break those rules, or that what's important is people's intention, I suppose, in breaking the rules. So if people actually intend to harm other people, which psychopaths do appear to be able to do, right, they should be held criminally responsible. But again, if you look at the way these things are actually applied in practice, it does seem to me that very often you are looking for the conditions of moral responsibility as well. So the example that I discuss in the book, and it's not original to me, it's something that's often found in literature on criminal responsibility, is the example of Andrea Yates. So Andrea Yates was somebody who I think in Canada, I think was found guilty. She was charged with killing her children. She did kill her children. but the reason she killed her children was because she thought they were going to go to hell if she didn't. So she had a kind of complex set of delusions, mm-hmm. which meant that she thought she was saving them from, you know, an eternity of torment. Mm-hmm. And she was acquitted, and she was actually acquitted under a version of the McNaughton rulings, which is interesting because it seems, because traditionally the way the McNaughton rulings is interpreted is to say that if you understand that what you're doing is illegal, that's enough for you to be criminally responsible. But it seems like in the Andrea Yates case, she did understand that what she was doing was illegal, right? But she thought that she had overriding moral reasons for doing it anyway.
Yeah.
So, you know, by her own lights, she was kind of acting as a moral hero, I suppose. She was doing something which was against the law and which she knew that, you know, everybody would think was appalling, but she was doing it. She
genuinely believed
that. She genuinely had the interests of her children at heart.
Yes.
Bizarre as it might seem. But, so the question is whether you think Andrea Yates should be exempted from criminal responsibility. And it really seems, you know, there's a lot that could be said here, but it seems to me that there are good reasons for holding someone in that predicament, not holding them criminally responsible. And I guess that's, why do I think that? I guess it's because, well, if your delusions, you know, are leading you to the conclusion that you have these really fundamental overriding moral reasons that speak in favour of your doing something illegal, then that would give us a reason for exempting you from criminal responsibility as well as moral responsibility. It's not obvious, is it, that? But I don't know. I think in cases where, so if you think about kind of a case where somebody genuinely does seem to have those kinds of overriding moral reasons, you know, which would typically be cases where the law itself is immoral, then I think we would probably, or I would probably want to say that the law shouldn't hold that person criminally responsible because the law's at fault, I suppose.
And that's sometimes an important mechanism for progressing law. To be more aligning with what we think is moral, kind of trailblazers or people who stand up to things.
It's difficult, isn't it, though, because that doesn't, I suppose that kind of consideration doesn't apply in this case because this person isn't genuinely a moral trailblazer, so we're not thinking maybe the law should be changed. So again, you know, this isn't a conclusion that I'm, you know, very, very confident in, actually, in the criminal case. But it does seem to me, I mean, I guess it just seems to me humane to make conditions of criminal responsibility track those of moral responsibility in the vast majority of cases. Because I think if you're in a situation where you're punishing someone who you don't think is morally responsible for what they've done, then there's something going wrong there. I don't know, what do you think?
Oh, what I think. I've not written a book on this, so I'm not sure I've got many developed thoughts. I guess my thought is there are a number of functions to the law, and one of them is basically to just set the guide rails and to contain fallout from everyone doing things in a kind of free-for-all manner. So If it's the case that in order to convey that this is just unacceptable behavior, maybe we should hold psychopaths criminally responsible, even if they can't be held morally responsible. And that may just be for the sake of, well, you've got to have the limits and the walls, in place so that it sends a communal message. And also there is a function to, I guess, the penal system, which is about containment. So if there is such extreme behavior that someone inclined or able to commit those kinds of behavior would be otherwise out in society and posing a threat, then the function of the court system is to remove them and contain them. So
absolutely. So I think it's worth kind of just thinking about the practicalities of this a bit as well. So yeah, absolutely. So part of there's deterrence, isn't there? And there's containment. So in practice, so currently, psychopathy is not generally in most jurisdictions, I think all the ones I've seen, taken to mitigate criminal responsibility. If it was, it would probably be as part of something like the insanity defense.
Yes.
So if you, now, if the insanity defense was available to people with psychopathy, if you're acquitted under the insanity defense, at least in this country, I think, you end up with something called a special ruling. So you're acquitted of the crime, but you're not then automatically released. Because you still might be a danger, right? So there's still this kind of containment motivation that we have. Even if somebody's not criminally responsible, there might be good reasons for keeping them away from society because they might be serious danger to other people. So if that kind of defense was available to a psychopath and they successfully used it, what might happen is they might end up in a secure institution. Mm-hmm. And then the way of getting out of that secure institution is not to have stayed in there for the duration of a determinate sentence necessarily, but to perhaps to demonstrate that you're no longer dangerous. And that can be quite difficult for psychopaths to do. Firstly, because as I said before, you know, the prospects for treatment of psychopaths are quite bad, or appear to be quite bad so far. And secondly, because psychopaths are famously manipulative, and so you can end up in a predicament where it's impossible to conclusively prove or convince decision makers that you are no longer a danger or that you've changed, because anything you say can be interpreted as being manipulative, right? Yeah. So, I mean, if you've read John Ronson's The Psychopath Test, mm-hmm. there's a really interesting case in there, right, where he talks to somebody who's been diagnosed with psychopathy and they're complaining that there's nothing they can do to get out of the secure hospital that they're in because everything they do is a catch-22. Yeah, everything you do is automatically interpreted as being evidence for the disorder. Mm. So not wanting to be in that situation, it might be that actually a psychopath and their defense lawyer would just never enter that plea because you'd be better off just going to prison because at least there you've got a sentence. And if you stay there to the end of your sentence, or there's various considerations around parole and stuff and whether you commit more crimes while you're in there. But basically you might have a much better chance of getting out eventually. So it might just be that even if that plea existed, it would just never be used. Yeah. So what we're kind of talking about here is kind of in principle, should that be available, even if in practice it might just never be of any use to anybody.
Mm. So we've covered a lot of ground, I feel, and perhaps we could consider what you're doing here as laying the groundwork as well for further exploration of
absolutely these kind of issues. I think. Yeah, you should also always consider yourself to be doing that in philosophy, really.
Yeah. So, maybe we could wrap it up there. Unless you have any concluding final remarks you want to sort of offer up.
No, that's great. The only thing is I feel like we didn't quite get into some of the issues that you're interested in around kind of attachment and trust and those kinds of things. So maybe at some point when you've done a bit more thinking about that, we could do a follow-up episode where we get more into that.
I'd say if I'm to offer up anything as a groundwork, I really need to refine those to something. At the moment, it's a bunch of scattered ideas. But yeah, I'd be interested in talking to you more about those as well.
Great.
Cool. Well, yeah, thanks very much, Jim. Thanks for talking. And I hope it's been an enjoyable and interesting listen to our audience.
Thanks, Andy. Yep, I hope so too.
The Idea Pod is produced by the Interdisciplinary Ethics Applied Centre at the University of Leeds. Find out more at leeds.ac.uk/ethics. Music composed and conducted by George Armitage.